Of those struggling with addiction and trauma, today's guest says, "We are not bad people trying to be good. We are wounded people trying to heal." Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, and I welcome you to this edition of Mind Talk. And I am pleased to introduce you to today's guest, Judy Crane. Judy is a certified addiction professional, a certified sex addiction therapist, a certified hypnotist, a specialist for healing trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, and she is the author of the focus of today's conversation, Trauma Heart, Stories of Survival, Hope, and Healing. Judy Crane, welcome to Mind Talk.
Pamela, thank you so much. I'm really honored to be invited and have the opportunity to share with you and your audience.
Well, Judy, let's sort of start from the beginning. You say that trauma is visceral, sensory, and cellular. It sounds like you're saying trauma is all-encompassing and sort of fills up or can fill up every space of your being. Is that what you mean?
That's exactly what I mean. Every experience that we have in life, every single experience we have, the taste, the touch, the smell, the feeling, the intuition, as well as the cognitive piece of it. But every experience in life, everything that happens is experienced that way. And oftentimes we're not aware of it until something comes along and a smell comes wafting by and it triggers some memory, some thought, sometimes wonderful, sometimes not so wonderful. And it can happen with a touch or the sound of something. And to understand, for me to finally be able to understand that that's the way people experience the world, it's also the way I have recognized that people experience healing. We cannot talk people well. That just doesn't work. It's insufficient.
So when you say we cannot talk people well, what more do you believe is essential for healing?
I absolutely believe in all of the experiential pieces therapeutic work, things like psychodrama and art therapy and equine therapy, things like art and music and all of those pieces. Within that framework, of course, we're talking and we're sharing and we're creating a dyadic relationship with our clients, but we're also talking about the somatic healing, the body, the way the body heals. So things like yoga and massage and breath work, things that connect with our body functions, again, how we experience the world. All of those pieces, in my estimation, have to be part of a very large therapeutic toolbox. And so although most therapists are really good at talking and hopefully they're better at listening, it's the other pieces that really make this a full, complete toolbox, so that we can be aware that the people sitting in front of us heal in very different ways. Not everyone heals in the same way. And so what might help one person to have an experience and have an aha moment will be entirely different than what happens for someone else. And if we're not prepared for that, then that's when our clients don't have or don't get everything that they need.
You mentioned a few moments ago an experience that, you know, in the scheme of things would be considered a fairly benign experience, and that is the sense of smell. You can smell something, but for someone who has gone through a trauma, it can trigger things that they did not imagine would be triggered simply by that smell. For those for whom that is the experience, particularly if they aren't aware or aren't anticipating that, it's easy for them to think, what's wrong with me? I'm going crazy. I'm losing my mind. What do you say to them?
It is such an incredible therapeutic opportunity when that happens. and hopefully they, you know, they're in a position where they can be talking to someone. You know, people who have experienced, for instance, childhood abuse, or have been in an automobile accident where the smell of the tires on the pavement might trigger that the heart pounding and the adrenaline rushing. I think probably the most important thing that happens is the ability to help someone to be aware of what's going on. I've often had clients say, there's that smell, there's someone in the room that has on a certain cologne or a certain perfume. It's making me ill. I'm uncomfortable. I don't know what's happening in my body. And being able to help those folks take that back. Where have you smelled that before? Where has that been a part of your life in the past? Those are those times when the memories get triggered. And our job is to be able to help to guide someone to that. It can be a very frightening moment when that happens because you're caught unawares. I don't know what that is. Where did that come from? And it's the same with sounds. For instance, I've had a client who had, you know, had really shut down a lot of memory, had been, there were a lot of childhood beatings. There were anticipation of beatings to come, knowing when your father gets home, your name is up on this board and he's going to punish you. And that anticipation of the beating was so visceral. But my client didn't realize how visceral until one day we were in a group and someone was rattling change, coins around in their pocket. And the sound of those coins in that other person's pocket just set my client off, because that's exactly the sound that he would hear when his father was walking up the stairs, down the hallway to come and punish him. So it's those kinds of really nuanced, interesting things that have happened to us in our life that create these connections. And for most of us, becoming aware of that and understanding why certain situations, walking into a certain room, being in a certain kind of light, or having someone touch you in a way that might be familiar in a not so wonderful way, which might be familiar in a way that has been triggering in the past. So those are the kinds of things that we talk about: sensory, cellular, visceral. It is so imbued in our body and our sensory system, what happens to us in life.
And so, in fact, if someone has that experience, it's not that they're going crazy. It's not that they're losing their mind. In fact, they've perhaps opened a door to some really important work that needs to be done towards their healing.
That's precisely it. When I say that about, for instance, the gentleman with the change in the pocket, that was the beginning of an incredible series of healing events that took him back to those memories, enabled him to explore what had happened, enabled him to explore it as a little boy of 5 or 6 and experience that way and recognize how much terror that little boy felt, and how often that experience, that feeling came back to him in very unexpected times in his life. For instance, with a boss or somebody else who had some power, that feeling, that experience would come back. Being able to recognize where it was generated, where it was birthed, is powerful. That's an incredible therapeutic healing moment.
You say very early on in The Trauma Heart, and I'm quoting now, there is a wonderment in unraveling the many parts of our family tree. For those who have been trauma survivors, the idea of unraveling the many parts of the family tree can actually be fairly terrifying. How is it that you characterize it as having a potential for wonderment?
I think that the best way to explain that would be that, you know, I'm in recovery and I've done this work myself, and everybody who works with me has done their own particular work with this. There are so many mysteries in our own behaviors. You know, how many times have we said, I don't know why I do that. I don't know where that came from. I don't know why I can't intervene on that. And that part of the unraveling is so powerful. Frightening, yes, but it's when we can take someone back to the memories of their childhood, when we can take them back to their family tree and we can understand, for instance, growing up in a family where maybe your father was a Vietnam vet and not being able to understand his agony, his pain, his anger, his silence, and then somehow being able to have a conversation with a family member, with mom or with dad, that says, this is why I'm silent. This is not about you and what I'm looking at with you. This is about my inability to be present in the moment with you, which is, you know, that's a pretty advanced way to say it. But for instance, I guess one of the best stories is this, when I was a little girl, my mother and I'm firstborn, my mother and I did not have that attachment connection in the way that she had with my sisters. And I truly didn't understand it. And I really felt like the black sheep in the family. I just didn't feel as part of as I recognized my sisters did. And later, in unraveling my mother's history, and it was painful to understand, but my mother and father had met, and my mother was Catholic. My father was not. He was divorced. He had a child. And so when they ran away to get married in 1945, I was my mother's shame. I never recognized that. I just thought my mother didn't like me all these years and that I wasn't very, you know, that I wasn't such a good kid. And it wasn't that at all. She had been carrying the language of her family that said, shame on you. You know, you're having a child in the Catholic Church that was considered out of wedlock. And so it was the feelings that she had for me were so mixed. Love me as her child, but at the same time be, you know, having that shame and remorse and pain around me, which created, again, just a terrible energy in our relationship. When I had this conversation with my mother about 10 years ago and understood that, I want to tell you, I'm 71 years old now. We had that conversation. I was 60. All of a sudden, all these things fell into place, and it made such beautiful, perfect sense. The relationship that my mother and I have as a result has changed so dramatically because now I get it. But it was painful and it was uncomfortable. And there were lots of years when I just felt alienated from that particular part of the family. I don't know if that helps or if that makes sense, but I've watched that happen with clients over and over again when I can help them to understand your behavior makes sense when you understand the whole pieces of your story. And the pieces of your story don't just begin and end with you. There are generation upon generation that have created who we are today. And that's the part.
It makes perfect sense. You talk also, you say that part of your trauma was deprivation, you know, on different levels. And mm-hmm. You said that shoes were your solution. And, you know, I have to confess that there are a fair number of those in my closet as well. You say that it was an expensive solution to your shame about being poor and yes. about being judged. Say more about that.
Do you know, Pamela, it's interesting how, you know, I have these pieces and these revelations, and then something else comes up. So I have a closet full of shoes. When I was a little girl, not only did, you know, I had a pair of sneakers and I had a pair of school shoes, and without fail, there were four of us, four girls, and without fail, there would not be a new pair of shoes coming for a very long time, and there would often be holes in the soles of the shoes. And so would have to put cardboard in the shoe, go to school and have cardboard in the shoe and hope that nobody was looking at the bottom of my shoe to see that. And what I realized, again, 10, 20 years ago, was some neighbor gave me a beautiful pair of shoes. And it was there was a strap in the back, and it was a peekaboo toe. And those shoes were just beautiful. How that neighbor knew, I don't know, gave me those shoes. And the feeling I got around putting those shoes on my feet and seeing that they and feeling that they made me feel special, that memory stayed with me forever. So that, you know, I jokingly say this when I'm speaking, when I'm on the road and I'm at a conference and I'm sitting in my hotel room and I'm feeling a little lonely, I look out the window and there's Nordstrom's or Macy's and I think, oh, I know how to feel comfortable. I know how to feel less lonely. And I walk across the parking lot to Macy's and go into their shoe store in their shoe department. And without fail, the brain chemistry starts popping. I start feeling some relief and release. And I know that I can buy a pair of shoes. And if they fit well, I'll buy them in every color. And all of a sudden, I'm not lonely and I'm not anxious and I'm fitting in. And it's the craziest thing. And I look at them and I laugh to myself and I chuckle and say, well, okay, I get what's happening. It's an old survival mechanism that has just survived over these many years. Now, I'm getting a lot better. I haven't bought a pair of shoes in a few months.
Good. That's good.
but it's there. It's there. And ultimately, those behaviors are really honestly about survival. And when we can trace it back to how did that help me survive that moment, that time in my life, those events that were happening or the things that were happening to me, what were the pieces that helped me survive? And shoes happen to be one of them.
And, you know, shoes carry so much symbolism with them. That's a whole other conversation. You talk about feeling responsible for everything that was wrong with the people in your life. And a lot of children feel that way. It's such a tremendous burden to bear.
Yes. Yes, it is. You know, we call that being parentified. In my family, I was the oldest child, and you know, I was a pretty smart child. I was, you know, somehow, you know, I'm a very good problem solver, but I learned that as a child. I mean, I learned that as a child. My mother would say to me, she would have me make the phone calls, for instance, to the landlord to tell him the check was late and in the mail. When you're a 10-year-old child, that's a big deal. You know, it's a double-edged sword. Okay, my mother trusts me enough to make this call. And at the same time, here I am. I'm a child addressing a situation and trying to solve a situation which is filled with shame. But that was my job. I was the oldest child, and I took care of my sisters. I solved situations that were way beyond the years that I have. And I see that all the time. Now we call them codependents, but those codependents are the people, you know, we kind of laugh at that phrase, but the reality is that's something that's imposed really early on, whether it's emotionally, physically, psychically imposed on someone. But we learn that early, that I am responsible for making sure that everybody in this family feels okay. And if they're not feeling okay, I need to do something to fix it. I think that's why so many of us become therapists.
You say that at the core of your spirit was deprivation.
Yes.
Emotional, physical, and economic deprivation. Is it important for each of us to understand what is at the core of our spirits? We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up with that conversation. Thank you. Judy, how important is it to be able to identify what is at the core of one's spirit?
Pam, I think it is pretty vital when we're doing this work and when we're unraveling the trauma to be able to get to that peace. You know, it's different for everyone. The thing that drives us, the thing that creates the energy around the behaviors that we have to wrap ourselves in so that we can feel safe, so that we can feel okay in the world. For instance, yes, for me, when I sort through that, it's deprivation. And let me just say this. This is not, that deprivation was not anybody's fault. It was the energy around the way my mother was raised, the way her mother was raised, the way my father was raised. It's how they came into the world, how they operated. And that's how I operated. You know, people didn't do a lot of hugging and kissing. There were not a lot of I love yous. That was very rare. The financial deprivation was there, and the things that came with that. But there are folks that come to me and say, I have been angry my whole life, and I don't understand why. Well, if you're operating from this place of anger your whole life and you don't know why, then the behaviors just keep happening. The way that we operate in the world comes from a place of anger, and it's not going to change, and it's not going to heal until we understand where that anger came from. And suppose the anger came from mom having a really bad in utero experience, and that all of the brain and body chemistry while you're in utero is the beginning of where the anger starts, because it can. Suppose where you're coming from and your spirit has been laying in a place of depression forever. And if you don't understand the why and the wherefore of that depression, it is, you know, it's virtually impossible to change the course of that action. Lots of times, the traumas that happen to us are pre-verbal. And we don't have language for what happened. We only know that something did. We can call it the yuck or the stuff, or we don't know. But if we can't get a picture of it, we can't change it. And I've recognized, and the people that I work with, my staff, we recognize that if we can help someone to go to that place and take them back to the place of where did that first begin? Where did that first feeling of anger, rage, sadness, depression, deprivation, where did that begin? Where did that start? That unraveling is the place. That's the place where you can begin to change it. And so when people come to do the trauma work, oftentimes they'll say, this is never going to change. I'm never going to be able to stop being depressed. I'm never going to lose that anger. But it's not true. It's being able, it really is about unraveling that and saying, now I understand. And if I can understand, if I can put the puzzle pieces there, then I can begin to do something different. So for me, I think understanding the core of your spirit is vital. In addition to that, understanding the bright and shiny part of your spirit that's sitting there is vital as well, because that's where your resilience lies, and being able to tap into that.
A few moments ago, you said something that I'm sure a number of our listeners are really kind of wondering about. Mm-hmm. When you were talking about the core of your spirit, and you talked about the in utero experience, I know there's somebody saying, in utero? Well, how am I supposed to get at that? And what am I supposed to do about that?
And, you know, I'm sitting here with a smile on my face because you know, recently I've done this with a particular woman's group that I was facilitating and asking this question. What can you tell me about what was going on with your mother and father when your mother was carrying you? What can you tell me about what her pregnancy was like with you? And this was a really important question for a couple of these women because they didn't know. And we happened to have a family week. And so we asked mom what was going on. And And one mother in particular said to me, at the time of that pregnancy, my husband did not want a child. And I was terrified that he was going to leave me. I was pregnant, and I was terrified that I was going to be left alone with this child. I was sad, I was depressed, and I was frightened. And as much as I wanted that baby, I had all of those other feelings. And I never told anyone. I never told anyone. And she told this group those feelings, and it made such sense for her child, who happened to be a young man, that those were the feelings that he was having as he was growing up. And he didn't, you know, he hadn't understood at that point, what was that about? Why was there sadness around the relationship with his mother? Why was there this angst around the relationship with mom and dad? And why did he feel like he didn't fit in? Well, you go back to those pieces and you begin to understand that what I watched is the healing that happened between him and his mother as a result of knowing that, being able to say to her son, that was all about my feelings, and I'm sorry that it impacted you in that way. Let's heal that. There are people, of course, women who are being physically or emotionally abused during pregnancy. What's that look like for the baby? What's that look for like for that in utero child? Now, I'm a recovering alcoholic drug addict, but in my addiction, I was using. How did that impact my children? How did that impact the baby? Not just chemically. How did it impact them because of the amount of shame and guilt I was experiencing as a result of not being able to stop? So that's when we're talking about in utero. Suppose you're walking the streets of Hungary, and you're a woman who just lost both of your parents to the Holocaust, to the concentration camps, and you're walking around in terror and fear, and you're pregnant. How does that impact the infant? That's the pieces that I'm talking about. The interesting part, though, of that healing is when you get that history, when you can get that information, the ability to heal that changes, and is, that's the wonderment. Oh my God, I can heal this. Oh my God, now I understand. And those pieces fall into place.
So the ability to heal is clearly there with the awareness of what your life was like, of the things that impacted you, even to the point of your in utero experiences. Does it go further back than that?
Yes, it can go back generationally. So and you know, we're beginning to see more of that. There's of course we understand DNA, and we're understanding more about epigenetics, which is wonderful for your audience to look at. Epigenetics is a new arena that's helping us to recognize that our DNA can change, that that through generations we can go from, for instance, in my family, I am the first recovering alcoholic drug addict. Now we are now at, my children are in recovery. My grandchildren have, you know, there is no response at this moment in time for them with alcohol and drugs. We anticipate that by the fifth generation, we can change that DNA that's there that says you have the potential for alcoholism and drug addiction because those things are changing. So when we look generationally, you know, there's every reason in the world to understand that I was going to be an addict and an alcoholic. I come from an Irish family, potato famine, lots of drinking, all of those pieces. How if I can understand the generations that my family has experienced, again, what I find in doing trauma work, it is when we begin to get the answers. I think one of the things that causes more trauma is the not knowing what happened, not knowing why it happened, not knowing how it happened. And when we start the knowing, there, I have seen more times than I can tell you, the aha moment. It's like putting this big puzzle piece together, a puzzle, and that when that last piece goes in, and it's like, well, of course this makes sense. of course this makes sense. And when we can make those pieces make sense, miraculous things happen.
You know, I think about some of the folks who will say, what's the point of talking about the past? The past is the past. I don't care. It's done. I need to talk about today. And In fact, what you're underscoring is that sometimes the past isn't done until you talk about it.
And that's precisely it. We carry the past with us, whether we want to or not, because we can recognize our behaviors are directly related to, you know, to our past. And again, you know, someone will say to me, you know, I keep having the same relationship over and over again. It's just a different man with a different name. Same kind of person over and over again. I don't understand why I do that. I understand what that's about. You know, so we're talking about the present, but the reality is we're talking about the why of the past. Why does that happen? What are the things that I need to change? So I guess what I would say to your audience is, you know, I love Oprah. Are you living your best life? And if you're not, why not? What is it that needs to shift or change? And where are you going to find the answers to that? We don't want to beat up the past, and we don't want to live in the past. But the past is, for most of us, our history is what unlocks the door to having this magnificent future. When I work with trauma survivors and we get to that, when we walk through all of that pain and the darkness and we get to the other side of it, that's when they find, and we find, and I say that for myself as well, we find a life of purpose. Because now my life not only can make sense, but I can do something with it. Because as a result of what we've experienced in our life, we have incredible gifts. There are miracles and things that happen. People are shocking. Well, how can I come from a family of Holocaust survivors and find any miracle in that? But there are. There is resilience. There are intuitions. There are things that we develop as human beings that come directly from the pain of our past. And being able to look at that, being able to see that, I think, is the power of being human.
Talk for a few moments, if you would, about Zach's story. He says that he started drinking and having sex at a very young age.
Yes. And let me just tell you, Zach, what an amazing, beautiful young man he is. Had been in NAV treatment over and over again. His story started, he was a very much a sports kid. And so it started when he was really young, between 5 and 8, already playing sports, baseball, soccer, and he was sexually abused by a coach at a really young age. So between 5 and 8, somewhere along there, he started being abused by this coach. Now, the thing that happened was this coach, the language that he used made Zach feel wanted, made Zach feel admired, made Zach feel sought after. So those feelings, being sought after, being looked after, being loved, being admired, those feelings were really big feelings. So over the years, that's what he started to look for. There was lots of sex addiction. There were lots of drugs and alcohol. So he was having this double-edged sword of being a sexually abused child who was also looking to be admired and wanted. And so over the years, drugs took over. He was hiding the pain with the drugs and alcohol. And at the same time, he was seeking relief in sexual behavior, in relationships. And it took him an awful lot of pain to get to that place. He became a cutter, which self-harm is not about suicide. It's about getting relief or getting a release. And so there were lots of those pieces. When he came to treatment, he'd already attempted suicide several times as a young man. He comes from a beautiful, beautiful family who were in such pain because they didn't know the whole story. They didn't know what had happened to him. And when the time came for him to be able to tell his family that in treatment, it shifted and changed and helped with the relationship with his family. They supported him in every way. And the pain his family was experiencing because he attempted suicide several times was so overwhelming. His father is a marine biologist, and his father was on the island of Saipan on a cliff that's called Suicide Cliff. And he was looking out over the cliff, and this is where the Japanese had thrown themselves over the cliff to commit suicide as opposed to being captured by the U.S. Army. And his father wrote to Zach and said, I wish you could see this cliff. I wish you could see. If these people had only turned around and looked the other way, they would have seen this beautiful bay and maybe would have made a different choice about living. That particular letter from his father was so impactful. Zach began to look at things differently. Up to that point, he had woken up every day and said, this is a good day to die. He went to Saipan with his father and was standing on Suicide Cliff and saw exactly what his father was telling him. He looked over the cliff and he saw that, and then he looked behind himself and he started crying. And he said, what I would have given up if I had died, if any of those suicides had been successful, would have been the gift that I just saw right here. That young man is, what a gift he is to us. He works for us. He is such a power of example to the clients who come in. He is able to be able to walk through his pain with other people. And that's, you know, that's the purpose that he's created for himself, is to be able to help other young people to heal. And amazing family, amazing young man. And so many of our folks don't have that. They don't have the person who's going to support them and say, we're going to love you through all of this. Right. And he was blessed to be able to have that, as well as really good treatment.
And it's interesting that you say that Zach was also a cutter. Usually when mm-hmm. we hear about cutters, we hear about girls. We don't hear about boys very often.
You're right. And the truth is that many, many of our young men are cutters. Many. It is, you know, like most things, that our women are more open about these things than the men. For years, women have been talking about their sexual abuse, and men, it took a long time for men to be able to do that. And now we know that there is a enormous number of men who are sexually abused as well, climbing up on the same percentages as women. And we're discovering that there is a lot of self-harming behavior with men as well. And it's not always cutting. Sometimes it's tattooing in dangerous ways. Sometimes it's physically hurting your head in lots of different ways, but it's for the same reason. It's to get relief or to get release. Either I want to feel something or I want to numb myself. And that's what self-harming behavior is about. It's, I have no other way to get relief or release, or I have no other way to feel. And this, and somehow they've discovered, you know, what self-harming behaviors do. And oftentimes there's peer pressure among some of our younger folks. Try this, you know, try this. And unfortunately, cutting has become a drug of choice, so to speak, for some people.
It's so scary what is happening with many of our young people. Judy Crane, we're going to take a break, and when we return, we will continue discussing the trauma heart, stories of survival, hope, and healing. We'll be right back. Judy, can you give us a sense of the range of experiences that could constitute trauma in people's lives? We're so used to thinking about soldiers or assault victims, but there are many other things that can have the impact of a trauma.
Yes, there's so many other things, and I think that's one of the disservices that we do, is that we don't, you know, that so many people don't understand the width and breadth. Trauma can be any negative event, series of events, or happening in someone's life that changes the way they vision themselves and their place in the world. That's a simple definition that I've created. However, what that looks like is, it looks like automobile accidents. It looks like medical issues. So, for instance, if a child has early childhood surgeries, those things are very traumatic. It looks like adoption. You can be adopted from the most magnificent family, but somewhere at the core of that is a place that says, I was given up. What's that about? And there's a primal wound there. There is neglect and abandonment, and those are pretty big words. And what does that mean? Neglect can be as simple as being a latchkey kid growing up with a single mom who has to work and can't be emotionally available all the times that you need to be, spending time alone or with your siblings as a kid and not having a lot of adult support. Abandonment looks like divorce happening. And as well and good as families attempt to do divorce, there's always a place there that creates some angst and pain for not just the husband and wife who are experiencing divorce, the couple that's experiencing divorce, but for the children. And you can do a really, really good job of helping your kids through that, but there's still a place that the family has been upended. If you are moving multiple times, that can be traumatic. Our folks that grow up in military families and move from one base to another, to another, to another, have to start over and over again in lots of different schools, start over with new friends, are constantly finding themselves having to readjust. And of course, we know bullying. Bullying is such a huge trauma. And that begins to happen early on. And it's interesting, or shocking actually, how many times families are not aware that their child's being bullied, not because they're being neglectful of their child, but because our children oftentimes keep those feelings to themselves. They oftentimes don't talk about it out of having a feeling of their own shame or expectation that there must be something wrong with them if they're being bullied or if they're being called names. So the breadth of trauma is enormous. What's trauma for me is not necessarily trauma for someone else. And one of the things that's very important when we're doing this work is to make sure that we help our folks understand that trauma equals trauma equals trauma, and that you cannot compare yours with anyone else. The impact of trauma is individual and can't be measured, only in the way in which you're doing the work. So we'll oftentimes have our folks come in. They tell their trauma stories. They share with one another. They're doing some really intense work. And someone will say, "Oh, I'm embarrassed to tell you what mine is because it doesn't even measure up to yours." Can you imagine that, measuring up traumas? But the reality is, the depth of trauma has to do with the depth of how it impacts you emotionally, physically, spiritually. It doesn't matter what the trauma is. What matters is how it has impacted you in that moment that it's happening, in those series of moments that it's happening, and how it impacts you today, long after the event, because we carry those trauma events with us long after they have happened to us. And we operate in the world with those unresolved traumas.
I'm so pleased you made that clear, because you're right. So many people will say, my trauma is not big enough to really be a trauma. My pain's not important enough for me to really talk about. And that is never, ever the case. You've created something in the Trauma Heart entitled Reflective Sketches, and you ask the reader to ask questions of themselves, such as, do you have secrets that you are keeping? It's an interesting question.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest, that's one of the biggest questions. And people are always surprised when we do, when we bring that to group, tell me about your secrets. We, you know, we have a secret group. We ask people to write their secrets and on a paper and put it in a bowl. And then individually have the group just pull out a secret and read someone else's secret. The things that we carry as human beings is extraordinary. The things that we carry as children that we keep secret, we keep family alcoholism secret, we keep anger and rage in a family secret, we keep infidelity secret, we don't talk about a family member who might be disabled. There are so many places where our secrets, and you know, there's in a 12-step fellowship, there's a saying, our secrets keep us sick, but it's true. And when that happens for a child, when a parent insists that a child keeps secrets, they have created such a moral, ethical, spiritual dilemma for that child. And our children will carry those secrets. There are so many times when I have had a client come and say, you know, my father was cheating on my mother, and he introduced me to his girlfriend and then told me I wasn't allowed to tell. And I never told my mother. And I always had this pain around it. Those kinds of secrets. Can you imagine asking our children to hold those secrets? But we do. That's not uncommon. Don't tell your mom that I bought that extra radio or that extra CD. That's between you and I. Now, that sounds a little frivolous, but that's the beginning of creating a blockage to intimacy. It's asking our children to again be parentified, giving them a burden that's not, shouldn't be theirs to carry. They keep the secret of sexual abuse because the perpetrator often says, I will harm you or your family if you tell. If you tell, they won't believe you anyway because they'll think it's your fault. So there are so many places where we keep secrets. And again, I cannot begin to tell you how often someone will come to me and they're 32 years old, and for the first time, they're beginning to tell the secret of being sexually molested at 6 or 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine carrying that secret for all those years and living with that? But we do it all the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. After you ask the reader if they have any secrets that they're keeping, you go a step further. Why are you keeping the secrets? And then an important step further, which is, what is the payoff for keeping this secret? What are some of the payoffs for keeping a secret?
My dad will love me better than he'll love you. There's a payoff that now I have some power over someone else because I've got their secret. Now, a child doesn't recognize that that's what's going on, that I have some power. It's just that feeling. It's like, you see how much they love me? You see how much they trust me? Gave me the secret. I must be special. I must be important. There's the payoff that now I know something about them, and there's, you know, I may have some leverage. There's so many different things that those secrets give us. For me, there were secrets that's part of what kept me so parentified and kept me in the place of having to solve the family problems, because I was also keeping family secrets. And it wasn't until I was grown and with my sisters that we were having a conversation, and this secret that I had been carrying for such a long time about infidelity, I had been carrying it for such a long time, and I had it as an adult, and my sisters started talking, and this conversation came out, and one of them was laughing and joking about a situation, and I realized that I wasn't the only one holding the secret, that it really hadn't been a secret. The two of my sisters knew about this, And I didn't know it. And I had carried that burden for all those years. And it was painful to carry. And there it was, right out in the open. My sisters knew it. And I had been carrying it to protect everybody else. Now, there's a certain amount of childhood arrogance in that, too, mm-hmm. of protecting everybody else. But, you know, but that was my role. And I think that there are an awful lot of us who have that role.
The instruction to write the secret down in a letter and mail it to yourself, how powerful.
It is so powerful. And when that letter comes in the mail and you open it up and you see it, the recognition of the power that that secret has had over your life is amazing. And it's so healing, Pamela. It's so healing to get that letter and be relieved of the secret, so to speak.
Are there people who won't open the letter?
Yes. Yes. And there are people who will never tell the secret. I'll go to my deathbed with this secret.
And to those folks, is the trauma heart something that they can read without the assistance of a clinician, or would you rather them work through their secrets with this book and a clinician?
I'd rather them work through it with the book and a clinician. So when I am working, when I get these phone calls from people who need some help, and we're inviting them to come to treatment or come to an intensive, and that's what they're looking for, I also ask them to pick up the book and begin to read that, because it begins to help them to move toward in that path toward, is this, you know, how is this going to work? And there's some relief in understanding what trauma looks like, and that there is in fact a path to healing. So I always invite people to work with a clinician if that's at all possible. And the book is, you know, the book does some wonderful, interesting work, and it asks questions that other people don't ask. And I think that over the years, therapists often don't know what questions to ask. And I think that this book helps us to look at, okay, what are the questions that I need to ask? And where are the places that I don't have to be afraid, that I can step in here and ask those questions and help someone get some relief? I think oftentimes as clinicians, we're afraid of what we know, what we don't know. And I always invite clinicians to do your own work, to do your own trauma work before you ask somebody else to do it. I tell my folks, I need you to snot and weep and wail and cry, just like your clients are going to do, so that you can get to the other side of your pain, so you can help someone work through their pain. It's important. It's powerful work. And as clinicians, we have an ethical obligation to do that.
What are some healthy, soothing behaviors in which folks can engage as they're going through these processes?
Well, what I'm always going to tell people is begin to do some of those body things that are important. Pick up yoga. Make sure you start having massages. Allow yourself to exercise so that your body and brain chemistry can get into sync together. Find yourself a group, a therapeutic group, a support group, places where you can find kindred spirits. So that, for instance, if you've been through suicide, you might be able to find a group that's a grief group for suicide survivors, or the survivors of suicide. Find out what it is that gives you joy and peace, and be able to make sure that you bring that into your life while you're doing this work. I know that for many of our clients, music is one of the most important things that they have with them. They bring their iPads, they bring their earphones, and music helps them to walk through all the things that we're working on. We are in a forest, so being in nature is incredibly helpful in while you're doing this work. Being able to be up and about and around people, never doing this work in isolation, not ever, not ever. making certain that you have made someone else aware of what you're doing, and helping to bring them in as a support.
Judy, how do listeners get more information about the work that you're doing?
I would invite them to go to our website. It's www.theguesthouseocala. That's OCALA.com. The Guesthouse Ocala. We have folks who will help to send you to therapists in your area, will help to give you some tools that you might need, can give you some advice on what might be available, the resources. And so we're always happy to help with that. So it's www.theguesthouseocala.com. And our folks answering the phone will be right there to help you.
And again, folks, I've been talking with Judy Crane, who is the author of The Trauma Heart, Stories of Survival, Hope, and Healing. And she reminds us, we are not bad people trying to be good. We are wounded people trying to heal. Judy, thank you again for joining today, this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you, Pamela. Thank you so much.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download Mind Talk from the iTunes Store or the Google Play Store. That's the free Mind Talk app that's available to you, and then you can listen to it on the go. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to hear any comments, any questions, any thoughts you may have about this conversation or any conversation that you've heard here on Mind Talk. So send an email to me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.